Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the web edition of STEM Spots. With me in the studio is Rhonda Leslie. She's the director of the Missouri State University Counseling Center and a licensed professional counselor herself. Thanks for stopping by, Rhonda.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Rhonda, talk to me a little bit about and frame for me sort of the situation when it comes to counseling in the university as you see it right now.
So one common trend right now is that we're all bursting at the seams with the demands for students. It's a national trend that we're seeing. Students have been requesting services at a rate that's really difficult to keep up with it. I think part of that is because we've increased awareness, which is a wonderful thing that students are learning that we're here to help them. But then there's the issue of managing that demand.
When you talk about that, so what levels are we talking about? You showed me some data that showed that since 2009, the numbers are up to, you know, significantly, like a factor of what, 4 or 5 or something like
well,
that.
Well, yeah. So what I can remember is that since 2015, we've doubled our numbers. We served around 700 students a year back in 2015, and last year we served over 1,400 students, and this year we're definitely seeing an increase again.
Now, of course, presumably you have not seen an increasing number of staff at the same levels as the students have been increasing. Is that true?
We actually don't help staff anymore.
No, I'm talking about how many staff you
have. Oh, the ratio, right. So we have increased staff, definitely, but not at the rate that we need.
Right. So just out of curiosity, how does the responsibility of this program lie? To whom do you report typically? Who sort of oversees the running of this institute?
Sure. So typically, it's the Dean of Students here at Missouri State University and the Vice President for Student Affairs.
Okay. And so what kinds of things are they interested in? I mean, you would think, and this is the interesting thing, in this particular case, you'd like to see the number of patients go to zero. Except that's bad, but maybe it's good. So talk about that. I mean, they've got a struggle here. You'd like to see people doing well enough that they wouldn't think that they need to come to a counseling center while recognizing, of course, that with the way things are right now, people need a counseling center. So what kinds of things are they looking for? Are you trying to, you're not trying to say we want to maximize our numbers. So you're trying to maximize approachability or availability. What kinds of things do you do in that regard?
Yeah, I would say it's a balance. We definitely want to serve. We know there's a need. In fact, we know that there's a greater need for services, but there's still the resistance. People have a stigma around mental health. It's definitely decreased, but we know that there are people out there right now, students out there right now, that need services that don't feel comfortable coming in. So we want to continue to educate and make those services available and easily accessible. At the same time, we know that there's a number of students that won't really need to see a counselor. They may need some kind of other service, such as a web app, perhaps a workshop or a couple of group sessions, etc. So we're just trying to meet the variety of demands. And of course, there are students that need medication as well, and we can refer those students to Majors Health, which is also, you know, in the building where we're located in the Majors Health and Wellness Center. So we're trying to make it very convenient, accessible, and do as much as we can with our resources that we have.
Let's talk about people's perceptions a little bit. So you mentioned this whole idea that sometimes people have an internal block to getting counseling. And what's interesting to me a little bit about this is that if you think about psychoanalysis and that how that sort of came to the fore, at least in an East Coast sense back in perhaps the 50s and 60s, where Woody Allen, for example, who I liked his movies very much at one time, used to talk all the time about going to see a shrink, and people would do this. And it seemed to be almost a badge of honor among certain circles. And yet now it doesn't seem like it's gotten necessarily to the point where in the Midwest, at least, people are happy that they need to go to a counselor. What kinds of attitudes do you see? And have they shifted, or how are people feeling about this sort of thing?
I believe they have shifted some. The stigma is down. There may be one or two studies out there that I'm familiar with that say stigma is definitely decreasing, which is a great thing. But I don't think it's to the point where it's a badge of honor. People are definitely more willing to openly say that they've seen a counselor, that they've needed some assistance in coping with their own mental health issues.
When you meet somebody, we'll talk more about this later, but if you meet somebody, how much of this time initially must you spend or should you spend or do you spend getting over people's guilt? Because I know that when people go to see somebody, many times there's a resulting guilt from that. They feel ashamed or worried that they're failing somehow. So do you have to get people over that hump before you can start to help them with their actual problems?
I think there's a percentage of students that we do work with that on, but I would say, you know, perhaps it's less than 20%.
Okay. Because we talked a little bit, you and I, maybe we can discuss this a little, about how sometimes the older generation always seems to put, you know, cast shade, as it were, to the younger generation. It's been going on since time immemorial. You're dancing the Charleston. Who's Elvis Presley? The Beatles are Satanists and so forth and so on. And now one, of course, the pejorative term is snowflake. Would you say that you see anything in students? I would say from interacting with a lot of students that I do not see what I would consider snowflake behavior. This I'll melt at the first sign of trouble. But do you see anything that's different, would you say, over the last number of years that you've been working in this field?
I have to say I hate to stereotype that way as well, but I do think there have been some significant changes when you look at, you know, the changes in Generation X and Z and IY, et cetera, et cetera. I think some of our students now just have different priorities. I think they're dealing with a very digital, a very screen, almost obsessed world. So along with that comes very special challenges with just balancing all of that and balancing the whole social demands around that. I think students, it seems like they're connected to home more than perhaps we were, or in a different way than we were, and more dependent on you know, family and kind of the home life that they left and in order to attend college.
Well, that's a good point, because does that mean that it helps if a family is supportive of their seeking out counseling help?
Definitely. It's so helpful when the family's supportive.
Great. Now, talk about the university environment, because another piece of this would be that many people think you're in college. That sounds like fun. I wish I were in college, but it isn't all it's cracked up to be.
No, it's
is
not.
It? So talk about the university environment and the ways that that actually plays a part in this.
Yes. So if we think about student schedules, many students are taking a full load or over, and they are engaging in organizations. It's not uncommon that I hear students involved in two or three organizations, and oftentimes they're, you know, they're playing a significant role in that organization. They're trying to balance, again, a social life and studies. We know the demands that, you know, you're supposed to study X amount of hours outside of the classroom, and you know, everybody's thinking about someday I'm going to have a job, so I want to do really well so I can have a good resume and get the kind of job that I want. And students have financial pressures and stresses. Students have a lot of social pressures. And I think although social media is very good for some kinds of social interaction, it's also not very effective in other ways and actually causes a lot of problems with just students feeling isolated, even though they're connecting with people online. So,
right. Now, in a marriage situation, I've heard it said before, and I know it's a gross generalization, that there's three primary things people fight about: money, kids, and then the third thing. And so in this particular case, have you noticed certain trends? Is it just that people are overwhelmed? Is it that they can't find a balance? Is it that they aren't organized well enough? What kinds of things really rise to the fore as being the things that are, let's say, compromising their ability to function?
Well, we know that the majority of students coming in are stressed and anxious. So we work with many, many students on it. Just anxiety management. Depression is usually the second most common issue. followed by, you know, these change year to year, but relationship issues and academic concerns and financial stress, and then just a whole list of, you know, other less common issues. And so I think a lot of students struggle with organization, just how to manage all of those demands, and that's creating stress. There's a high need for outstanding performance. There are expectations of outstanding performance in a university setting. So I think that creates a lot of stress and anxiety for students. And, you know, just basic self-care. Sometimes our students aren't eating or they're not sleeping. It's really common that students aren't getting the recommended, even, you know, 7 to 9 hours of sleep for life satisfaction.
Sure. I used to drink a Dr. Pepper for breakfast when I was an undergraduate, so I know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not proud of that fact, I don't think.
I think that's still occurring.
Yes. Yes. So let's talk about approaches. Students come to you, and then how do you go about figuring out what they need? Do they do surveys? Is it one-on-one discussions? What kinds of options are there?
That's a great question.
And so let's just lead us through that.
So initially a student will call us, schedule an appointment, an intake. Depending upon the time of year, you know, it can take a few days to a week. Actually, right now we have a waiting list because we have such a high demand for our services. But once they get their first appointment, they fill out kind of a demographic information on our tablets, and we have every student take the CCAPS, which is an inventory of psychological symptoms. The counselor has a chance to look at that before the student comes back. And then the counselor and the student really have a discussion for about 45 minutes on everything that they've been dealing with. They talk a little bit about the past too, but we're very future oriented now. We do primarily solution focused brief therapy in our office. We also have a specialist that works with trauma, which is a little bit different approach there. But in that initial hour, we're actually asking students to set goals for themselves once we've had this conversation about what's going on, what their challenges are, even what their strengths are. Then we work on those goals in the following sessions.
So you talk about solution-based, so that's interesting to me, because when most people think there's a solution, then of course they think I've identified the problem. But it's got to be more complicated than that in this particular case. So how do you go about framing a solution when the problem can be somewhat nebulous? I'm fascinated by the idea that, because when I talk to students, and as a department head for many years, I would hear from students, and it was such a mishmash of things, you could not tease out exactly necessarily, except in instances where there was a trauma of some kind, why exactly there was the problem. So how do you identify, how hard is it? Is it always clear what the problem is?
No,
let's put it that
no,
way.
It's definitely not always clear. But we do, you know, it's kind of a complicated process, and it depends on what the student's bringing to the table as far as their issues. But we ask them, you know, what would their life be like if suddenly things were better? How would they feel differently? How would they act differently? How would they approach life? And lots of times you can tease out some symptoms in that and then focus on, tweaking it a little bit between now and the next week as far as, okay, if we changed two or three things, if you put a little effort into, you know, this situation or this symptom, what would it look like if you came back in next week and you had some success? So, again, we are very solution-focused. We're trying to help the students get some relief quickly and realize that they have some of that power within themselves to make those changes to feel better and cope better.
Let's talk about stigma again a little bit. So this is protected by HIPAA, I presume, and you probably don't even have to acknowledge that somebody was a patient. Is that true?
That's true.
Because people get this worry, and I've seen it actually, because in physics we sometimes deal with students who have to end up getting security clearances, and people were worried about any kind of a flaw in character. And back in the day, that encompassed all sorts of things, which would be way off limits today, because it mainly was talking about what they considered attitudes and issues that could give people leverage against you, which they don't want. So presumably you can lay to rest any worries that students would have that this is going to impact how anybody views them. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. We are completely confidential within the limits of safety. So, you know, we would only break confidentiality if we believe somebody was a danger, an imminent danger to themselves or others. Or if they wanted us to, you know, provide information to someone, we can have them sign a release. Other than that, everything they talk about is totally confidential.
Great. Talk about your staffing and your services directly. So in other words, how many people work there? What kinds of backgrounds do they have and that sort of thing?
We have a good variety of professionals on our staff. If you include me as a director, we have 9 professionals that are full-time doing counseling on some level. We have 4 graduate assistants who they often come to us very new to the field. These are students in our Masters of Psychology, Social Work, or Counseling. And they come to us, learn, you know, the basics of counseling. We coach them, we supervise them, and, you know, before you know it, they are counseling students, and they do a great job. And we have a lot of students that request our GAs, actually, to be their counselors. Then we hire a part-time counselor as well. And we have psychologists, we have licensed counselors, licensed social workers, we have substance use specialists, we have trauma therapists, so a wide variety.
So just something came to mind when you mentioned substance abuse. Presumably that impacts at some level sometimes these issues. And so I would presume that the number one is alcohol and number two is a combination of marijuana and everything else. Is that fair to say?
I would say yes, that's right.
Okay. And so do you encourage people to modify those kinds of behaviors before they try to deal with the other kinds of issues they're having? Or is that always done, or is it something you leave up to the student?
It just depends, yeah. We kind of try to identify the primary reason they're coming in. I mean, if they are binge drinking, we know binge drinking increases typically anxiety and depression. So they may have a variety of symptoms, but it could be tied back to their binge drinking. So if that's what we need to focus on and the student is willing to change that behavior, then that will become the primary focus of the counseling.
Very interesting. Well, Rhonda, I think we've covered a lot, and I really appreciate you stopping by. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.